Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly and I'm joined today by Nigel McCollum. Nigel is my biomechanics coach. So maybe you can do an intro. Who are you, Nigel?
Yes, hi, Chris. Thank you. My name is Nigel McCollum and as you say, I'm a biomechanics coach based in Gullen, which is just outside Edinburgh. I've been a biomechanics coach for over 5 years now. Previously before that, I have been and still am a Pilates instructor and a personal trainer and a remedial and sports massage therapist for about over the last 15 years.
Excellent. And so I first met Nigel a few years ago through a very close friend, and Nigel was helping him with his back. And I didn't really have any problems with my back, but I had been riding rounds on my bike for a number of years with a plastic wedge underneath one of my cleats. And so if you're a road cyclist or a triathlete, you probably know what I'm talking about. The idea being that this wedge, it fixes a leg length discrepancy. And that word fix is kind of a curious one. Admittedly, it did work for me. Like I felt better and felt like I was producing more power once I inserted this wedge underneath my cleat so that my legs were the same length. But I'm not sure that was the best possible solution. So maybe, Nigel, you could give a bit more information about what the heck was going on there.
Sure. Yeah. Presumably at some point, to come to the conclusion that you had a leg length discrepancy, you've been to like a bike fit guy, right, or some local who would have assessed you maybe sitting on the bike and done some measurements looking at the height of your saddle, how far the saddle is or how close saddle is to your handlebars, and come up with the idea, you know, for a specific bike fit, and come to the conclusion that you maybe have one leg longer than the other one. So these are what we would class in the biomechanics world as an extrinsic measurement. So if you were to divide the science of biomechanics into two separate sciences, you'd have the extrinsic measurements, so like your bike fit guy, or even somebody using some video analysis or gait analysis where they're doing observations, or maybe some use or some work in a laboratory where they're looking at specific points like the knee, the ankle, and the hip, and in relation to how you move or how you function. That's not what a biomechanics coach is looking at. We're looking at the intrinsic biomechanics of yourself. So we're looking at things that you can't really see through observations. So we're looking at specific measurements done through screenings, which will be able to test function of specific joints and muscles, and also looking at the neural system as well to see whether or not that the various joints and systems through the body are actually functioning. And from that, one of those screens that I did on you when I first met you, I came to the conclusion through these measurements and tests and screens that you had a leg length discrepancy. Now, okay, we have to determine whether or not that leg length discrepancy is something you've been born with or something that you have developed through poor posture or a muscle spasm or something similar that which has, you know, led to you having a leg length discrepancy.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think in this instance, the discrepancy was measured quite crudely by placing a piece of wood across my knees as I sat up against a wall or something like that. And, you know, my coach, he didn't really understand where the difference was coming from. He said it could be a difference in the length of your femurs, but it might be something else. I don't know, but it doesn't really make much difference to me. I'm going to put this plastic cleat in there anyway. And it did kind of work, but it's like kind of stupid, especially when you get to the mountain bikes, because there's no real way to insert a wedge on a mountain bike. There's just no elegant solution. The pedals just don't work like that. So tell me a bit more about the screening process. How exactly do you figure out whether this discrepancy is something to do with the length of the femur or whether it's something else?
Sure, yeah. The brains behind the biomechanics coach system is a guy called Martin Haynes, and he comes from Nottingham. Now, for several years, I think it's almost 30 years, he has been a physiotherapist, but his specialty has been in intrinsic biomechanics. So he's been doing a lot of lab work with lumbar motion monitors and video analysis and so on, and quite a lot of expensive kind of gadgetry and machines that will measure these extrinsic movements and interesting movements as well. So he wanted to take that looking at those systems and then develop something further which could be used as a kind of, you know, a more hands-on thing without the use of the specialist equipment. So he came up with several screenings, and I think we're looking at over 20 different screens.
So a screen being, you asked me to perform, I'm lying on a massage table and you asked me to perform some movement, and then based on what you see, you make a decision.
Well, majority of the movements are done by, you know, myself. Some of the screens, I have to put measurements with a pen on your ankle, for instance, which then give us a true kind of accurate measurement of whether you have a true leg length discrepancy or whether this is something that's been something you've been born with. So we then attach a screen to that movement. So we have a pelvic function test called Downing's sign, which doing various movements through the leg will then tell us whether or not that side of the pelvis, according to that leg, has the ability or the capacity to function, as in it can rotate posterior, anterior, or forwards and backwards, and can that happen on both sides? And that doesn't happen on both sides, then you're looking at a rotated pelvis which has been abnormally rotated and has stuck in position, which would then give the appearance of a leg length discrepancy. So basically one side of your pelvis has hitched up, or it's gone forward and it's either pulled the leg down or it's brought the leg up, and then your ankles wouldn't match together. So you therefore have a true and accurate description or a method of screening whether or not people's leg length discrepancy is there, and also whether or not the pelvis is functioning correctly or functioning properly.
So you're telling me that the pelvis, the two parts of it, actually move independently, and it's possible for them to get... Okay, yeah. So that was definitely not clear to me before I first met you, and I'm not sure I fully understand it now, but that seems to be like a crucial piece, like in order for you to get two legs that are of different lengths.
Yes, I mean, there are several tests out there. I think it's over 20 different tests that you can do, or screens that you can do for testing or assessing pelvic function. The ones that Martin and his team chose are the three ones that we have available to us that are Downing's sign, the four sign, which is also known as Faber's test, and the Gillet's test. And they're just various different ways in which you're assessing pelvic function. And from that, you can build up a really good picture of what was going on through the pelvis. But then it's from those three tests that, you know, you can then determine whether there is good pelvic function, and also tells you which side of your pelvis isn't working, because you can have a longer leg or a shorter leg. You don't actually know which one is shorter, which one is longer, until you've done these pelvic function tests, because your one of your legs could have been pulled forwards and down, but that's the pelvis has functioned isn't functioning that side, so it gives the appearance of a longer leg.
Okay.
But it could be taken as it's the left leg or the other leg that's the shorter one, so you're not absolutely sure which side isn't working or functioning until you've done the Downing's sign, the Downing's test.
That's pretty cool. So then you gave me some exercises to do, and I went away for quite a long time. Nigel obviously lives in Scotland, and I'm here in California, so I don't get to see him every day. So it was quite a long time before I saw him again. And we repeated the same tests, and mysteriously my legs were now the same length, which was quite remarkable. So tell me about the exercises that you had me do to fix this problem.
Mm-hmm. So from the pelvic function test, we determined that there was one side of your pelvis wasn't functioning properly. Now, usually the reason for the pelvis not functioning properly is a specific muscle in your glutes called your piriformis, and that's quite a key player in pelvic function. So from that test, we determined which side of your pelvis wasn't working properly. We then assigned a corrective technique or a corrective exercise to the piriformis on that side that wasn't functioning properly. Now, this is a very unusual way of releasing a muscle spasm, because that's basically what was happening in piriformis, was there a muscle spasm, rather than it being looked upon as being a tight or a short and stiffened muscle. We're presuming it's a spasming muscle. So then you need to do a technique called an anti-spasm exercise, which It's done from a wee bit of research done by a guy called Dvorak. He's a neurosurgeon, and he came up with the idea that a low-grade endurance muscular contraction is the best way to release a muscle spasm. So we were going to take that piriformis into a low contraction, which will then ideally, or you know, according to his research, will then free up that muscle. So we did that. We performed that anti-spasm technique, which is that low-grade muscle contraction. And we did that four times, according to the principles that we have, the 20% contraction for 20 seconds, and we repeat that four times. We then reassessed the leg length discrepancy and the pelvic function test, and we found that your pelvis had regained functionality or function on the side that hadn't previously been working prior to the muscle release corrective technique we did.
Okay, yeah, so I should describe the exercise. And I think maybe the easiest way to describe it is I put my arm, my forearm, underneath my my glute as I'm sat down, and then I push
the back of my leg.
Yeah, so I'm pushing quite gently downwards with the kind of similar force that maybe I would use apply to a pedal on a very easy ride. So it's almost no force at all.
Yeah, that's correct.
Which is. It was a remarkably elegant solution, you know, like I probably spent more time on Amazon looking for some stupid gadget that was going to allow me to put this plastic wedge underneath my mountain bike cleat than I did doing the exercises, you know, so it's a pretty cool solution. And I'm wondering, you know, what happens to other people that are affected by this? How common is this? Is this something that's really unusual? Do you see it all the time?
Would say that the pelvis is 60% of the of back pain and knee pain, shoulder pain, spinal pain, the origin of that is 60% is normally due to the pelvis. So the pelvic function tests are really important to do, you know, your first screening to figure out whether this is a pelvic problem or whether this is something else, like a knee or a foot or shoulder, or even it's maybe more neural, like a nerve issue. So once we've done these tests, we then determine what are the best exercises to give the person away for, say, a week or so. Let them try these corrective techniques, maybe just one or two of them for 2 weeks, and come back. And if the pelvis is functioning when they come back in a week's time and you've had a result that it's been changed and it's got improved since the last time you saw them, then you know that what the exercise you've given them are the correct exercises or techniques for them. Had they come back in a week's time and there'd been no change, then you'd be thinking, well, maybe this isn't a pelvic issue. Maybe this is something else, like shoulder or knee or something neural instead.
Okay, so what you're saying is I could have come to you and reported any number of symptoms, and the root cause would be quite commonly be this malfunction, whatever you want to call it, dysfunction with the pelvis. So I might have come to you with a bad back or bad neck or something else, and it still could have been this same pelvic problem.
Yeah, I mean, we need to look obviously at the pelvis first, and then determine from that, you know, what is the true cause of the problem, what's the true root of it. I mean, it's often that the pain site and the pain source are two different things altogether. So, you know, you have the compensatory effects that the body is doing, because the body is the master of compensation. So you can come in with a shoulder issue, and because of the kind of fascial slings and systems that we have in our body, the true cause of that shoulder issue could be a spasm in the piriformis in the opposite side of the pelvis to the shoulder.
Right. So if I'd been, maybe I'd gotten away with it likely just because I'm a cyclist. If I'd been a runner and there was a lot more impact involved with the, you know, the force that I'm applying with my muscles, then I might have come undone in some other way that would have been worse.
Exactly. I mean, you could have come in to see me with an inside knee problem, and you know, all too often you go straight to the site of the pain, where using this intrinsic biomechanic screening that we have, if I had found there had been a leg length discrepancy and that it was also combined with a knee issue, then you could presume from that the shortened leg or the lengthened leg was then causing the knee to bend more in the way, or the foot to flatten more, or your lower back to be more bent to one side, or the shoulder to be dropped to one side. So, you know, the repercussions or the compensatory effects from the pelvis dysfunction can go up and down the body. So you have various other factors. And again, it depends what actions you're doing, I suppose, through the most through the day, what your function is, which will determine, again, you know, what joints are more going to be affected by poor patterns or poor dysfunction throughout the body.
Mm-hmm. So when you say root cause, that's something I'm definitely all about, figuring out root causes. And I understand what you're saying about the pelvis here, but I still feel like this is not the root cause. Like the root cause is not something to do with my pelvis. It's something to do with the way I'm sitting or the way I'm walking or the way I'm standing or sleeping or something. So how do you figure that out? I mean, what stops? So you've fixed me now. What's to stop that from happening again? Like, how do you identify the movement patterns that cause the problem in the first place?
Sure. Sometimes there are extrinsic movement patterns that people are doing on a daily basis that are going to influence the intrinsic patterns. So, for instance, let's say if you sat down quite a lot and you got yourself into a pattern where the comfiest position for you to sit in was to take your knee over your other knee, you know, kind of cross-legged sitting position that quite a lot of people do,
mm-hmm.
Straight away you're going to be putting your one side of your pelvis under a lot of strain compared to the other one. So a repetitive motion like that could potentially cause, you know, a whole list of issues going on to the pelvis. I mean, that's just a kind of a non-weight-bearing example, if you like, where someone's not putting that much stress to the body. But let's say through time that your body has become used to a pattern of dysfunction because you've been doing something in the gym that you've over-rotated your pelvis and it's caused a protective spasm to start in the pelvic region because of that over-rotation of your pelvis. Maybe because of lack of core stability or any number of reasons that can cause that as well. I mean, cyclists have themselves in quite a kind of forward flex position, which under some velocity through the legs and some power can put a significant amount of tension through the sciatic nerve. So the nervous system, again, kind of greatly overlooked that it's not that an important system, but the more we look into it, we realize that, you know, the way we sit, more and more people are driving to work, sitting at desks, driving home, sitting down to eat their tea, sitting down to watch TV, and then going into bed. And that whole day, they're putting a lot of pressure through their nervous system. And the sciatic nerve, being one of the biggest nerves in the body, runs very close and linked to the piriformis muscle. So if you have a tightened sciatic nerve or under compression, then any muscles that are surrounding that nerve will all go into kind of protective spasm. Piriformis will spasm potentially, the hamstrings, the calf muscles again as well. So just from, you know, purely the functionality of human beings at the moment, the kind of evolution that we've got ourselves into, poor posture, poor sitting, you know, poor just day-to-day kind of life is all contributing towards these dysfunctions we have in our body. So it's being aware of these and trying to kind of notice these things more and avoid these kind of overuse patterns that we've got ourselves into. And a corrective technique like the biomechanics coach system, which is going to then retrain the body into a better pattern, a pattern that hopefully functions better for what your needs are. And also part of this system that we use is a stabilization program. So we're going to teach the core muscles to be more responsive, that so things like an abnormally rotated pelvis won't happen as easily again around the next time.
Okay, it sounds like I might have been sort of doing all of those. I'm sure that's often the case, that the causes are multifactorial, and certainly in the years leading up to when I saw you, I was doing all of that, right? I was sitting a lot at work. I'm a computer programmer, or was then. And, you know, I spent hours and hours and hours on my bike, which is kind of more sitting. And then I'd be so exhausted from that, I would go home and do some more sitting on the couch, right?
Absolutely.
And then I suspect, actually, weirdly, that one of the root causes might have been, I have a deviated septum, and this is sounds kind of weird, like talking about my nose, but I can't breathe properly through my nose. And I actually had it operated on, which didn't really work. If you're ever thinking of doing that, think twice. It doesn't work that well. But anyway, one of the things I could do to get relief from that when I was sleeping was to sleep in a very particular position that would kind of stretch my face so that it would open up the airways. And then to stabilize that, I would kind of hike my knee up to sort of make the position stable, if that makes sense. And so that would be the way that I almost slept. And I kind of wonder now whether that might be contributing to it.
Yeah, almost like a recovery position.
A recovery position.
Well, absolutely. And those sort of things can all contribute through time. Your body gets used to that movement pattern, and it muscles all develop around those ways. I mean, your muscle systems will always be kind of evolved around your kind of functionality, you know. So muscles will develop in the way that they do repetitive movements over and over again.
Mm-hmm. So how often are you able to identify something really specific that you can help tell someone not to do? Like, would you, you know, can you be a detective and say, oh, well, this is something you're doing with your deadlift that you need to talk to your coach about? And, or is it ever that specific? Can you ever do something like that?
You can. I mean, obviously with your initial screening that you do with somebody, when you're sitting down having a kind of pre-chat before you go on to your screening, you can ask a few kind of specific questions about, has there been any traumatic events in your life, such as a car crash or such as, you know, they've broken their foot, they've broken their knee or something that would have altered their movement pattern in the past. So, you know, say for instance that they had broken their foot, that all that extra weight that would normally be taken through both feet has now gone more onto one. They're using a set of crutches, so their shoulders were involved in that action as well. And if those movement patterns that go into have never been corrected, then you're looking at the function has changed of that person, and that will stay like that until it becomes corrected. And then once the person regains their use of their foot and they go back to running or cycling, whatever it was they were previously doing before their injury, their body has kind of changed and it's evolved into a different pattern. Mm-hmm. So you find that they're not able to maybe function to the same ability as ever before, and maybe at a higher risk of injury. So basically you're looking to see if, can the pelvis function, can the shoulders function, is there a good movement in the spine like what we need to see? If there's a good function in the shoulders, good function in the pelvis, and good functions in the spine, the risk of injury goes significantly down. The risk of biomechanical issues goes significantly down as well.
Okay, so what you're saying is it's possible for me to become more resilient to this stupidity. You can't really avoid this stupidity.
Yeah, I presume so, yeah. That, you know, we've all got to understand and accept now that compared to 2 to 3 million years ago, our functionality has changed rapidly. So we're no longer the hunter-gatherer who was chasing after animals or being chased by animals or reaching up into trees or, you know, hunting and gathering like we were meant to do 2 or 3 million years ago. And then in the last 100 years, that function has changed rapidly. Mm-hmm. And it's evolved really quickly into being more sedentary, more seated positions. So our function has changed quite a lot. There's going to be aware of that, whether we need to try and train ourselves back up to the standard we were 2 or 3 million years ago, or whether we need to just try and train our bodies now to be more resilient at the function that is now in the modern world.
It's definitely something you need to be aware of either way, I'm sure. That sounds a very familiar story. Obviously, you know, we've talked about the paleo diet a lot, and it's almost the same story, right? Like, kind of our environment, our food changed more quickly than we did, and that's kind of left us with problems. Sure, what kind of, do you see like lots of common patterns? Like, you see cyclists with leg length discrepancies and tennis players with something else and swimmers with something else again. Does that happen, or is each person completely unique?
I think each person is completely unique, but if you have, because I see a variety of people. I see you're a high performance athlete, and I also see your average person in the street who has back problems or back issues. I think you can, more and more you can look at your sportsman and say, right, okay, here we have a basketball player who is, you know, a point guard. So, you know, maybe dribbling more than what, you know, other person in the team are. So they're going to be using their arms and their shoulders a lot more, predominantly one arm. Because most basketball players are stronger with one arm. So you could potentially see more biomechanical, kind of intrinsic biomechanical factors in that person's right arm, because they're always using that right arm repetitively. Mm-hmm. And bear in mind that, you know, everything is connected through the fascial system. So if you have a spasm in one of the shoulder muscles, then there's a high chance that there'll be a spasm in one of the pelvic muscles as well, or vice versa. So you need to look at the individual sport and say, okay, what are they doing repetitively? Like, if it's a runner, then you're probably going to see more kind of hip flexor hamstring issues. If it's a basketball player, you know, potentially more arm issues. A cricketer, you're going to see somebody who's bowling is going to be different to somebody who's batting. You know, more hyperextending shoulder problems from somebody who's bowling, and more rotational problems through the pelvis with somebody who's batting, more knee problems because they're always lunging forward into the same knee to then swing a bat round, you see. So it does become quite specific with sports people, but with the average everyday and the person in the street, again, they're all individual, but, you know, you can tend to see more. I see quite a lot of sciatic issues with piriformis spasms as well, because, you know, they're sitting down more or they're more sedentary. So you can see that kind of pattern emerging quite a bit.
So tell me about this. This is something that really interests me, the sciatica thing. So this, we're talking about back pain here.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to differentiate between sciatica, which, I mean, true sciatica is something that would need to be diagnosed by a specialist, you know, a surgeon, a clinical issue.
Right.
As opposed to maybe something like a compressed sciatic nerve, which there are various points down the sciatic chain that those areas can become tight or you know, in spasm. So the sciatic nerve is, you know, it can be the width of your thumb across. It's a big nerve, and it's like your power cord down to your lower limbs. So anywhere through the kind of chain that the sciatic nerve follows, you can have dysfunction there. And bear in mind that if you're sitting a lot, you're sitting on your buttocks, which are pressing onto the sciatic nerve through the various layers of tissue. It's in a kind of compressed position. It's in a flexed position. People who drive in a car quite a lot, there's a vibration that goes through the road that transfers its way up to the car and agitates the nerve, especially the sciatic nerve, which builds up fluid around about the nerve. So that kind of building up of fluid can cause compression as well. So that can all kind of give that idea that there's sciatica there. Like, so for instance, piriformis condition, where there's a tightness in the glute muscles, or even for some runners, the lack of hamstring flexibility, which, you know, you can have runners stretching from now until the day they die, and it will not increase their flexibility in their hamstring. But show them a sciatic nerve mobilization technique, and they can increase their range of movement in their hamstrings in a matter of minutes.
Yeah, that's really interesting to me, actually. I've spent much of my adult life doing kind of, I guess, what you'd call static stretching. I was into kickboxing when I was maybe 17 or 18 or 19, and we did tons and tons of, you know, box splits and all sorts of force stretching and stuff. And I felt like I did see some progress there with flexibility, but I was probably just quite flexible to begin with. But so what you're telling me is that just the static stretching that I was used to up until that point is not necessarily the best way of improving mobility.
Yeah, well, again, if it's targeting the hamstrings, if you're looking at a movement screening, like a functional movement screen, which identifies that you have a poor range of movement in your hamstrings, so let's say less than 70 degrees or 80 degrees of hip flexion, just lying down your back and lifting up one leg straight and trying to keep the knee straight, and you recognize that through that movement screening that you've got a shortened hamstring. Because the sciatic nerve runs down right into the middle of the back of the leg, how can we then determine whether that is just a shortness of the hamstring muscles, as in a lack of flexibility, or whether or not that somewhere up through that chain there has been a bit of compression put through the sciatic nerve, which has actually caused the muscles of the hamstrings to overly protect that nerve, and in turn has actually shortened the hamstring muscles. So if you're just doing a functional movement screen, you'll observe that and you'll note it, and then you'll assign a stretching program to that person for their hamstrings. But we haven't looked at the other side of the coin, that is, there is a potential for a sciatic nerve compression there. So in our movement our intrinsic biomechanics screening, we have a screen or a test that is then going to determine whether or not we have sciatic nerve tension or just a tight ham or a shortened, tightened hamstring.
Okay, I understand. Yeah. So finally, I wanted to ask you, what things should I be doing to avoid some of the pitfalls that we've been talking about? Are there are there like things that you see people doing that make you cringe because you know what the end result is going to be? Like, I'm just wondering, I don't really feel like I've, you know, kind of changed my behavior much, even though I've kind of fixed the problem, which is kind of disconcerting to me. So what advice would you give to people to protect themselves from injury?
Yeah, I mean, I do use a gym myself, and I do work at a local gym. And there is a big influence or a big desire nowadays to become a lot stronger and lift a heavier weight. So often, which leads to a bit of a compromise. So people will lose form just to stack up the weights. So, for instance, your deadlift that you said earlier on, even your squat patterns that people get themselves into. What can appear to be a quite a reasonably well executed squat without the intrinsic kind of screening that we do, we don't actually know whether or not everything is working inside the body. The intrinsic factors aren't working properly. So again, ideally, I would always recommend if there's a somebody like myself near you who does a kind of look into a bit more of the intrinsic kind of movement patterns and intrinsic screenings or biomechanical screens that we are doing, then that's going to give you a good insight into how your body is stacked up or currently functions. And then, looking at some corrective techniques, which will then, if you do have a day at the gym, that you do these corrective techniques prior to you going into the session, and you can also do them post coming out of the session as well. So you know that then that you're biomechanically as correct as you're going to be, and that your functional stuff in the gym is going to appreciate that, and it will develop more instead of this cycle of doing these so-called functional patterns that are movements in the gym. And because you're not biomechanically or intrinsically biomechanically correct, there's a higher rate of injury. So you progress for so far, and then you find that you injure yourself and you break, and that cycle can repeat itself over and over again. So looking for some way to try and break that cycle, that we understand our bodies better, we can assign corrective techniques to each system of the body or each joint, and we're preparing ourselves for what we're about to do, and also preparing ourselves for what we're about to do outside the gym as well, as not just in the gym, so office or driving the car and so on and so on.
Right, exactly. Everything's important.
Yeah.
So do you think I should be avoiding completely any kind of those, the machines where you sit down on a thing and it performs like a very specific range of motion, and there's not really, what I'm talking about, the machines?
Yeah. Resistance machines. Machines are definitely have their part, but I'd say the machines are they're better in the kind of first 6 weeks of a rehabilitation program. So I think it was Mel Siff that came up with the idea that post 6 weeks using machines for longer than 6 weeks, your body actually loses its natural kind of inherent ability to change direction, to move naturally. So if you're using machines on a daily kind of basis and for several months or if not years, then your body will become the machine, so you will start to move like a machine. So and bear in mind that a lot of machines are working in the same plane of movement. So you become very, very efficient in that plane of movement and very efficient for those movement patterns that the machine has got you into. But
right,
take you out of that and involve some triplanar movements or some, movements where you have rotation in the kind of the transversal plane, and it's hard or something, something gives because your body's just not used to working in those ways. So I definitely always advocate that in the first instance, you look into the kind of the rehabilitation using machines, but post 6 weeks, get yourself off those machines and onto more, I'll use the word lightly, but more functional movements that are going to be appropriate for your sport.
Okay.
Your needs themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then if I'm a cyclist in California listening to this and I've got a leg length discrepancy, when will the next time you be here be so that you fix all these people?
Yeah, as far as I know, there are biomechanics coaches in North Carolina, but it hasn't really reached over to the States big time yet.
Oh, really?
It's more popular in the UK. I've just enrolled myself into the Escape from Alcatraz triathlon next year, so I will be in California at the beginning of June 2015. So
you're gonna have to keep your plastic wedge until then.
Yeah.
Sorry. So where can people find you online then? And what area do you work with? You have to be quite local, obviously, to be able to work with you.
Sure. I mean, I can give you my website. And I can give you a few other websites.
Yeah. And so we'll link to that in the show notes.
Yeah. And if people want to look into a bit more into intrinsic biomechanics, they can find out a wee bit more about it.
Uh-huh.
Because the therapist, if you like, the intrinsic biomechanics coach needs to be there kind of hands-on to apply these little specific measurements to the body and do the screenings. And it's harder to do it online. I mean, I have done it before. Done it before with yourself, Chris, but it's not easy.
Yeah. It seems like you have been able to, my friend Ross, who might be listening to this, knows that you've been able to help him a lot remotely via Skype and through video. And so is that something that you kind of do at a push or is it something you would actually, you know, be willing to do with new people?
I mean, I trained up Ross's wife to do the specific kind of movement screens that I really needed to keep an eye on when I was back over at home. And that way you kind of built up a good picture of whether or not Ross was starting to function better. I mean, I did it with yourself, Chris, and I just had to kind of give you a few kind of pointers on where to place these measurements. And then with the great benefit of using Skype or FaceTime, we were able to see each other and I was able to watch what you're doing. And we just looked for a few specific screens and results and we took our results from that and then applied our corrected techniques.
Okay.
So it's not impossible, but ideally, you know, you want to have the kind of benefit of having somebody there with you and they can give you that very thorough screen and do all the screens that are available to us.
So it sounds like what people need to do is take a mountain bike holiday in the UK, fly over and ride in Wales or the Lake District or Scotland or something, and then give you a visit. And then once they've done that, you can then work with them via Skype and help them that way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's a perfect solution.
Or pay me across to the California.
Yeah, you can do that too. Actually, that is like what Ross did. It's like, okay, screw it. If like the one person that can help me is in Scotland, then I'll bring him here.
Yes, my website is www.nigelmcholland.co.uk. So you know, if you've got your lecture note or your podcast notes for that, probably easier to get the spelling from that.
Yeah.
But the other ones are, I mean, Martin Haynes has got his own website. So he's martinhaynes.com and that's MARTINHAINES. And there's also our main education provider as well, and she is again www.biomechanicseducation.com. And these are the guys that taught me everything I know about intrinsic biomechanics.
That's pretty cool. I will put those in the notes, so don't like crash your car or anything right now to go and check these sites out. That's brilliant. And thank you so much for your time, Nigel. This has been an extremely enlightening conversation, and I'm very grateful for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, cheers then.
Cheers.